Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast, the day after impeachment. And this is a good time for a flashback to 2014 when a certain real estate mogul called into Fox and Friends. This is what Donald Trump had to say back in 2014.
Do you think Obama seriously wants to be impeached and go through what Bill Clinton did? He would be a mess. He would be thinking about nothing but it would be a horror show for him. It would be an absolute embarrassment. It would go down on his record permanently. But they're saying, oh, he'd love to be impeached. That would be so good. And the Republicans are all saying, oh, we'd never impeach him. We'd never impeach him because he'd like that.
Well,
and the Republicans, and I'm a Republican, and the Republicans.
Well, that was then. And today we wake up in a world in which Donald Trump is only the third president of the United States ever to be impeached. You don't think that that is a blot? Just Google the name Andrew Johnson and see how far you have to scroll down before you get an article that does not mention the fact that he was impeached. So now we are in the new phase, the post-impeachment pre-trial phase. And the one piece that I have been telling everybody who will listen to me that you must read is the piece in the Bulwark by A.B. Stoddard. And A.B. Stoddard is in the house. Thanks for coming back, A.B. Appreciate it very much.
Thanks for having me, Charlie.
Well, before we get started, can we just comment on the crazy letter that Donald Trump, the six-page letter that Donald Trump sent to Nancy Pelosi, and the part about it is, no, seriously, the part that blew my mind more than anything else was the how much it revealed about Trump derangement syndrome. You had one guy who went on Fox and compared this letter, which is nuts, to the Gettysburg Address, and then there's Hugh Hewitt, who said, beginning, this was from yesterday, beginning the radio show, you see, he tweeted, by reading into the radio record the entire text of the Trump letter to Nancy Pelosi. It is a historic document and will be cited by presidential scholars for generations as the defining example of Article II blasting Article I. Wow. This is not a parody. I'm sure it made for riveting radio, by the way, reading this six-page letter into it. So, but it will be an historic document, and people will look back on this this particular letter, not perhaps in the way that Hugh Hewitt thinks.
Oh, wow. new Hugh Hewitt outdid old Hugh Hewitt, but now I think yesterday's Hugh Hewitt has even outdone recent Hugh Hewitt. That's a little astonishing to even think of.
It is peak. I keep thinking it's peak Hugh, but no, he manages
right,
to top it.
Right, they go further down the rabbit
yeah,
hole.
He does. And, yeah. then, and then he doubles down on it, basically saying, you know, he's taught constitutional law, and absolutely it's going to be in the case books. Really.
it was really an amazing thing in so many ways, because as we all noticed, it blended just him screaming onto an official stationery with some, you know, lines and graphs and you know, high-minded sounding arguments that some people around him gave him. So it was really disjointed and strange in that way, but a lot of it was, you know, irrational, but a lot of it was really sad because he was melting down. And the thing about meltdowns is you want to have them in private and not tell everyone that you're melting down, and exclamation points and all the insults and accusing Nancy Pelosi of lying about praying and just stuff that was just so had nothing to do with anything. I understand that he believes that because he believes he is, you know, an authoritarian, and that there shouldn't be a Congress and a check on him and a judiciary, but full of Obama judges. But he believes that because he has run a good economy, mm-hmm. You know, you can't impeach him on abusing his power or obstructing the Congress or obstructing justice or perjury or anything. And I think that's, you know, largely due to the life he's led, where he's been so protected by his financial comfort growing up in that family, and then professionally being able to sort of, through bankruptcy and other means, potentially tax fraud, you know, always kind of
Always skating.
You know, sort of chuck and jive through crises and come out where, you know, he's not the sucker. And that involves a lot of court appeals and stringing things along and running out the clock. And so I think as this moment arrives, he just – he felt that because he's not going to get witnesses on the Senate side to have, you know, the Real Housewives of the U.S. Capitol, he felt that he needed to have his dramatic moment and change the coverage that we talked about him all last night. And it was obviously pitiful, but the idea that – you know, Hugh Hewitt and others didn't want to just leave it alone and pretend to back to talking about the unfair process. This is beyond bizarre.
Yeah, no, I'm sort of wallowing Hugh. So he followed this up by saying, quote, this is again for a tweet. I've been teaching constitutional law for 25 years. It will be included in any serious casebook, beginning with the next edition of those on the market today. Commentary will vary, but the letter is unique. Yes. An interpretation of what it meant and if it succeeded will depend upon subsequent events. Yeah, no kidding. Well, yeah. And of course, President Trump is trying to suggest that, hey, there's no big. I'm totally cool with this. This is fine. This is a joke. This is blah, 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 blah. But I do think that that's why that call in 2014 was kind of in, you know, an indicator that he understands the blot that he puts on him. But, you know, listening to
Charlie, he understands that this is the problem is that he's often referred to Bill Clinton's impeachment and said it's the second thing that's mentioned after your name. And he's a brander and he knows that that's a stamp. And he really, really doesn't like that permanent stamp. He's very focused on those types of, you know, just
legacies,
logos, if you will.
Right. No. He actually, right, the logo thing. And he understands the power of Donald Trump, who was the third president impeached. He understands that very, very short narrative. Okay, so now we shift to the Senate trial, and it's now Mitch McConnell's show, and Mitch McConnell has made it very clear there's probably not going to be any witnesses, and you know, spoiler alert, the president is going to be acquitted, but you had a piece yesterday, the other day, in the Bulwark, that really underlined, I guess you know, put some detail into the concern that I have, which is that by rushing ahead with this thin, narrow impeachment, the Democrats have left so much on the table, and they really run the risk of firing their best shot before some of the most damaging information comes out. And so I want to start with this for our listeners. Our listeners need to know the name Firtash. And the fact is that because of impeachment, we're not talking about Mr. Firtash. So A.B. Stoddard, tell us about Mr. Firtash and why Mitch McConnell does not want us to be talking about Mr. Firtash.
Okay, so I am not Russian-Ukrainian gangster expert, but my people can read up more on him. But Mr. Firtash is in Vienna fighting extradition to the USA. He was arrested in 2013, and he's basically, I don't know what his various crimes are, but he's a member. He's involved in Russian organized crime. He is a Ukrainian, but he's connected to the Russians. He's a point man in the Russia-Ukraine conflict, which basically is a conflict that Russia created when they invaded Crimea and annexed it. So he has ties to Putin, ties to the Kremlin. And he, I don't want to go down too many Lanny Davis and Victoria Tunsing rabbit holes, but this is an incredibly, really greasy soap opera here where he has had people aligned with President Trump or close to President Trump helping him out in the United States. He was using Lev Parnas, who the listeners know was arrested on October 9th with Igor Fruman. They are Rudy's buddies, and everyone saw the pictures of them on Instagram at the Trump Hotel the afternoon of October 9th before they were busted at Dulles.
Let's slow it down now. Okay. Now let's do it this way. Let's do the big picture, and then let's go into the details. So tell me if I'm understanding this, that you're pointing out that one of the reasons why the Republicans are really anxious to get this trial over is because they are really concerned about what you described as the second Russia-focused federal criminal investigation and which Trump is really the center of all this. This is being investigated by the FBI as well as the Southern District of New York, okay? And it is a follow the money story, right? So
yes,
where does the money? So Parnas is this sleazy dude, and he's in court this week, and they're revoking his bail in part because they found out that he got a transfer for $1 million from Russia, right back in September. So I guess the question is, okay, let's follow the money. How does Russian money, Parnas, Giuliani, and Trump draw the line, and then we'll go through the details later.
Right. This is, as you said, what the big sort of headliner you have to start with is, we're in Russia investigation number two.
Right.
It is related to Russia investigation number one. And Trump is at the focus of it one more time. If Lev Parnas is funded by the Russians, and we know he paid Rudy Giuliani $500,000 several months ago for Rudy's capers in the Ukraine, digging up all this kind of dirt, getting the Ukraine ambassador fired, all the things Rudy's been up to. And Rudy has been doing it at the direction of President Trump. Then President Trump's election meddling is indirectly financed by the Russians.
Okay, that's a wow.
The Russian that Russian everyone money. Needs to pay attention to is mm-hmm. is Firtash. Sorry, mm-hmm. he is Ukrainian, but his funding is from Russia. He's connected right. to the Kremlin
so
and Putin.
So Russian money to Lev
is
Parnas,
indirectly
right.
funding it. Right, who then Russian
who,
money
who,
to Parnas
who
to
then
Giuliani
pays
to
Rudy
Trump.
Giuliani, who is clearly. Are there other connections with Trump or Trump world and Russian money?
Yes. So. I mean, well, there's connections to these guys mm-hmm. that we so the reason why this investigation that you mentioned that started in the SDNY and is spread to the FBI and so is the second federal criminal investigation Russia focused into Trump world is it's all focused through these guys Parnas because they have been charged with conspiracy, money laundering, a bunch of crimes. Mm. They basically gave $325,000 in foreign money they were laundering through their energy company called Global Energy Producers to a pro-Trump super PAC. So beyond Trump and Rudy, we know that America First Action is cooperating with this investigation. They are the PAC that received the money. That was now, prosecutors have told us, coming through a shell company. In addition, Ballard Partners in Florida, it's the most influential firm in Florida politics. Brian Ballard is the most influential lobbyist in Tallahassee and a top prominent funder for Donald Trump. He is also, he has been subpoenaed. Their company has been subpoenaed. The reporting says there's been no wrongdoing, but they've been subpoenaed in the case because they paid Lev Parnas, $45,000 for a client referral. It turns out he was referring the client to Ballard Partners that happened to be the Turkish government. Who else represents the Turkish government? Rudy Giuliani. And so because they paid Lev Parnas money, they found themselves in this investigation. Pam Bondi, the former Florida Attorney
weird.
General.
Yeah.
who is now the spokesperson for impeachment, just left Ballard Partners recently to come join the president on his campaign against impeachment. So the problem is a lot of people have been hanging around in connection with Rudy Giuliani and Lev Parnas, and so they've been swept up in this investigation. What is interesting, and I did not note this in the story, but I'll say it, now that I notice, and I don't know it for sure, but I know that the Trump, pro-Trump America First Action PAC is cooperating, but Ballard Partners was subpoenaed, which sounds like they didn't offer to cooperate. And where I want to take you now is to a former congressman named Pete Sessions, who in the end lost his re-election bid in the midterms, but was receiving some campaign money from Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman in 2018 in the spring. And got on their campaign, Rudy Giuliani and Lev Parnas's campaign, to fire our Ukrainian ambassador, Marie Yovanovitch.
These guys are busy, and they're everywhere.
Yes, and the way
and
that
well
Pete Sessions,
connected.
The way that Pete Sessions did. Oh yes, the Parnas and Fruman are everywhere. Yeah. I mean, if you, they've been photographed with Bondi, with Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, with Mike Huckabee. I mean, there's Kevin McCarthy received Parnas money, the top Republican House leader. Lev Parnas is everywhere, and so. For this congressman, while he was trying to get reelected and ultimately got defeated, was taking money, campaign money, from Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman and doing their bidding and helping, you know, the same caper that Giuliani was on, which was to fire Marie Yovanovitch. Mm-hmm. He wrote a letter criticizing her to Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. And the reason that it's important to bring up Sessions is this. Devin Nunes... Parnas's lawyer. Everybody knows that Devin Nunes is the ranking Republican on the House Intelligence Committee. He ran for 2 years the Russia probe in the House that came from the House Intelligence right. Committee because Republicans were in the majority and he was the chairman. He was involved in all sorts of embarrassing, ludicrous capers on Trump's behalf that landed him under an ethics committee investigation, of which he was eventually cleared. However, he lost his chairmanship for a while because of it, because of his conduct. He spent, as your audience knows, all of his time in opening remarks during the hearings talking about nude pictures of the president and rambling on about, you know, the media and all sorts of non sequiturs and looking extremely upset. He did not reveal at the time what we learned later, which is that he has connections to all of this mess. Because we don't just know that he showed up on an April 12th call record with Lev Parnas 2019, which we all learned ultimately after the hearings in the House Intelligence Committee's impeachment report. We know that Parnas's lawyer, who talks a lot because Lev Parnas now wants to rat out everybody.
Which is, by the way, the key point here now.
Right. That's why he's the time bomb.
Right.
He has hurt feelings that people pretending that they don't know him now.
Parnas seems to have turned
Parnas,
you said, it seems to have turned on Trump and Giuliani, which makes him a time bomb for Trump
yes.
world. So here's the guy who's connected, who's the nexus of all the money, who's got his fingers in everything, who has all of these connections. And now he's basically saying, I'm willing to say everything, tell everything I know.
Right. And his lawyers have made it clear that he is willing. He's going to testify that he did everything for Trump. Lev Parnas is going to testify he did all of this for Trump. He tells a story, before I get back to Devin Nunes, about being invited last December to the White House, December of 2018, to the White House Hanukkah party, getting a secret pull-aside visit that Rudy arranged with the president, at which point the president gave him this special assignment.
Mm-hmm.
Why did he get that assignment from President Trump at the end of 2018? I believe because he had done all this work with Sessions and Rudy and Nunes all year long and proven that he was a keen player and he was up, you know, he was legit.
You could basically say that these guys were telling the president, he's our guy. He's okay.
Exactly.
He's our guy. We got this from him, or he can connect us with this guy.
And he's delivered.
Mm-hmm.
The problem for Devin Nunes, a sitting congressman in House leadership, and a very strong ally of the president's, who did not recuse himself from these proceedings or reveal his relationships with these players, in this whole Ukraine scandal, is that, like I said, he did not only turn up having calls go, by the way, both ways. He pretends that Parnas' wife's phone must have accidentally called him on April 12th.
Sure.
The call records show the calls going both ways. The problem is that's 2019, and that Lev Parnas' lawyer is also telling us not only will Parnas testify he did everything for Trump, that he was helping Devin Nunes, then the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, in the spring of 2018, make connections with people in Europe.
Okay.
And so this has gone on for a very long time, Charlie. And there's what it means if Pete Sessions, the former congressman, has already testified to a grand jury. It means that at the very least, Devin Nunes has been contacted by investigators in this probe.
Now, see, again, we want to put this in context, because as you wrote in the Bulwark, and people who want to learn more about this, go back to A.B. Stoddard's piece, which is Why is Mitch McConnell Afraid of This Man? If Trump and Senate Republicans want to finish impeachment as quickly as possible, then they must believe the time is not on their side and that future developments are likely to cut against Trump's position. And this is, of course, what we're talking about here. And Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman, who were busted at Dulles International Airport, just remind people, on October 9th, after lunching with their business partner, Rudy Giuliani, at the Trump Hotel in Washington. And they've been charged with this long list of crimes. So they're already facing charges of conspiracy, false statements, falsification of records, and election law violations, funneling foreign money into campaigns, including pro-Trump super PACs. And the prosecutors have said that they're likely to face more charges. They've been subpoenaed by three congressional committees. And as you point out, Parnas has agreed to cooperate with them, providing audio and video and documents to House investigators. Okay, let me just stop right there. You know, okay, I understand why Lindsey Graham and Mitch McConnell and Donald Trump would say, let's get this impeachment thing out of the way before all this blows up. Why aren't the Democrats like, we're going, whoa, okay, you know what? We have this, we have the SDNY, we have the FBI, we have this guy willing to testify. Why aren't they, you know, waiting, or, you know, what are they doing with this information?
That is the $64,000 question. This is obviously something that you and I have talked about a long time pre Lev Parnas's. I've only known since last Thursday morning about last Wednesday night about Lev Parnas's, having what a court filing said was limitless foreign funding, turns out to be Russian. But you and I have talked about this for a long time, that they know that they could go, you know, through with the court proceedings for Bolton. They know that they could exhaust a lot of avenues. Don McGahn being forced to appear, a lot of things that they could do. Lev Parnas could come talk to them, but they haven't done. And they know that this is they know about this. And so it's fascinating. I know everything has been buried by impeachment, including this, of course. But there was also news out this week that the House has basically technically said the impeachment will stay open because it's continuing to ask the courts for more documents from the Mueller probe.
Right. But what does that mean, though?
So it feeds into this whole question about your proposal on impeach and withhold, right? Why are Democrats doing this to themselves when the explosion is going to come later? And why are they? Because they know they can't impeach twice. They probably can't even impeach if he's, you know, in 2020, if he, you know, after his next crime spree, if he's reelected. It's bizarre to me that they want to. It has to be a political calculation that they need to move on and dispense with this as soon as possible.
Okay, so
it's unpopular.
So what does this explosion look like? Let's run through a pretend scenario here. So they have the trial. It's a sham trial. There are no witnesses. Donald Trump is acquitted on a straight party line vote. And the next month, what is the explosion? What does it look like?
Right. So that's the problem. We don't know what it looks like because of Bill Barr. And that's the factor that I touch on in the piece,
he could squash this.
Bill Barr, as Attorney General, has the power to block any indictment in this country in any investigation. SDNY, for all of their prowess about their independence and being such a powerhouse, the very organization Rudy Giuliani once led 20 years back, is still a part of the Department of Justice.
Yeah. And he's fully capable of doing this. I talked with former Attorney General, Deputy Attorney General Donald Ayer on this podcast a couple of days ago, and he conceded, he could do that. He's capable of doing that.
And that is what we do, right? How much are we underestimating the potential malfeasance of the Attorney General? We just don't know at what lengths he will go to stop the truth. I mean, this is, you know, I don't know. I know that the investigation is very deep and broad. I don't know if Rudy Giuliani is indictable for what he did, if they're just FARA violations. You know, he's running around making all this foreign money and he didn't register as a foreign agent. I mean, I don't know what Devin Nunes did. Maybe Devin Nunes did nothing wrong and he's not going to get indicted. But there are serious questions about what he was doing on the taxpayer dollar in his official capacity There are already a potential, you know, ethics investigation into his travel last November over there to meet with a former Ukrainian prosecutor. So I just don't know what we'll learn.
Yeah,
I think Lev Parnas intends for us to learn a lot more. I think he's dying to talk. He gets his lawyer to talk a lot and respond to things frequently. We just don't know what Rudy will reveal on Laura Ingraham's show or to another magazine. I just don't know if there will be another whistleblower. You know, I don't
know
what
that's right.
We
don't know. Well, and then so you know, part of what is I think mind bending about all of this is the recognition that whatever has been going on is ongoing. That is a a crime in progress. Number two, as you point out, this is the second Russian-related investigation, and all roads lead to Russia, as many times as we have said it. So we are now talking about a completely separate story and a completely separate criminal investigation dealing with Russian ties to President Trump and to his inner circle, including the transfer of huge amounts of cash.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is the, I think maybe one of the successes that Rudy Giuliani has made is by sort of, vomiting it all out, that it's like the notion, well, if I'm admitting it, if I'm saying it, if it's all out in public, then it can't be wrong. When in fact, it is still mind-bending that after the whole Mueller investigation, after all the Ukrainian investigation, that this is still going on and that there may be major revelations. And again, for people who think that we're engaging in innuendo, this investigation of Fruman and Parnas is ongoing. The premier U.S. Attorney's Office in America is working on it. The FBI is working on it. Lev Parnas is saying that he has documentary evidence that he is willing to talk. So something's going to happen one way or another.
Right. And we just don't know if it'll happen after Election Day mm-hmm. or before. We don't know what, we'll learn. We don't know what might be blocked or stopped. Seth Abramson is someone who's written a book on the Mueller investigation, and he put out a theory on Twitter a few weeks ago that I thought was really interesting, that perhaps this was started a long time ago, and that Rudy's work started to basically go over and create a Ukrainian collusion narrative to counter Mueller, because Mueller was going to get Trump and they thought he was going to get him, and that they had to come up with another story, a counter narrative. And that it was once he got that going, and of course Rudy's been making some good money all along, running around working for free, but being close to the the most powerful man on the planet, that they get cleared by Mueller, and it's time to basically use all the connections they've made and the influence that they've gained to sort of, start going after Joe Biden. Rudy's been working on this since January. But some people say it's gone back into 2018. If Nunes was working anyway. So the question is, how connected are Russia investigation one and two? Doesn't really matter, but likely that, that they really are, and that all this stuff is ongoing, as you said. The president has made it perfectly clear that China should investigate. He told George Stephanopoulos he'd like, any dirt that foreign actors, states, governments have for him. And we know that there will have to be this as it becomes a sort of a louder threat when the country's not focused on impeachment, and if there are more revelations and developments, then we're really going to have to look at the Attorney General, right? We're going to have to see, if it becomes a crisis where people leak. I can't even imagine it, but we know that this is coming and it's going to come to a head. And what we already know is so bad. I mean, they were funneling foreign money into pro-Trump super PAC, And then they've also funded through Russian money the activities of Rudy Giuliani on the president's behalf.
This is what we know about Donald Trump, that he looks for revenge and that he feels emboldened anytime he feels that he's dodged the bullet. So, of course, the phone call
every
to the
time.
Ukrainian president was the day after Robert Mueller's underwhelming testimony. So you could certainly imagine that that Donald Trump and Bill Barr will engage in their most extreme behavior in the immediate aftermath of his quote unquote exoneration by the Senate. So, I mean, that's going to be an interesting period, I think. Okay, let me just step back for a second. I was reading, and I'm not sure that I fully formed my thoughts on all of this. Our good friend John Podoretz, writing in commentary, basically says, you know, this has become Animal House, the impeachment. He refers to it as stupid and futile. And you know, makes the point that, look, you know the fact is that you know, liberals and you know, the left has been wanting to impeach Donald Trump for all kinds of things, and they've been just looking for an excuse. So this is sort of the pretext for it. And he's sort of, you know, right and wrong in one respect. I mean, you know, it may be futile in the end, but it's not stupid. And it is worth admitting that, look, if Donald Trump was not Donald Trump, if he had not been engaged in so much misconduct, if there had not been a pattern of lying and deceit and abuse of power, then this Ukrainian thing probably would not have triggered impeachment. But it is this larger pattern and is the larger sort of penumbra of Donald Trump's misconduct. And I think there are two juries now. I mean, there's obviously the jury of the Senate, and we know what they're going to do. But then there's the jury of the public that has every right to connect the dots of Donald Trump's obstruction, corruption, deceit, you know, his bizarre, you know, projection of his own narcissism onto foreign policy, into all of this. So holding him accountable for this is not stupid. It may be futile, but it's worth doing. But I'm feeling very frustrated right now, knowing that this trial in the Senate is going to be rigged, that it's going to embolden and empower President Trump, and the Democrats have left so much other stuff on the table. And of course, now I've become a broken record because I've been you know moving on this. The Democrats seem so anxious just to sort of turn the page and move on. I think that's
a
mistake.
They are.
I think that's a mistake.
I do too. I think that you know, I've said this many times, if it's not political, then don't give it a political calendar. Find, you know, turn over every stone, throw the book at him, every crime,
right.
Go down every avenue. And so, I do think it's, they're making a political calculation on the timing, that it has to be forgotten about intentionally. You've said we'd all forget about it by the, you know, just after the new year.
Right.
I think that's what they want. And they're, of course, playing into the Republicans. Republicans want to be able to say, when the Parnas bomb goes off, oh, I had no idea when we acquitted him about this stuff. This is crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But it certainly imperils Mitch McConnell's majority if this unravels.
Well, let's talk about that. Let's talk about this, because you have been, you know, giving a great deal of thought and doing a lot of reporting on what's going on within that Republican caucus. So talk to me about the weird positions that Susan Collins and Mitt Romney are in right now. Susan Collins announced that she's running for re-election, and yet she seems to be getting killed from both sides on this at the moment.
Yeah, and I know I mean, Romney was made it very clear this week, and so did she, that, you know, they're sort of all going to hang together and behind their leader, Mitch McConnell, who is not Donald Trump, and they so respect their leader that they need to respect his process. And why did Schumer go to the media instead of going first to negotiate with their leader? And so, and Romney's doing the same. You know, I don't want to get out ahead of my colleagues. I think right now, we perceive this as futile and already over with, and something which
yeah.
we can see clearly. But I don't know that it's that way. I'm not saying that Parnas has any actual Christmas holiday surprises for us, but I think that what they have to do rhetorically right now is take the pressure off and just say, we're with Mitch. Look, you know, we'll see how it goes. But really now, you know, we don't want any monkey business. And
okay, so don't overreact is what you're saying.
Well,
is
no,
that Romney's
that,
keeping,
like,
his powder dry? He's just
because none of it matters until the trial starts.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's real.
Mm-hmm.
And then I don't think we actually know what tricks can be played on the Republicans, what leverage Mitt Romney might end up flexing on with some colleagues on Mitch McConnell. I don't think they entirely know. And so it was very shrewd of McConnell to talk Trump out of witnesses, or just to tell him flat out, I'm not going to do this for you, because it's politically self-destructive. But I think that we don't know. I think that, look, you know, January 18th is a whole month away. Mm-hmm. You know, Susan Collins is looking at her approval rating and her money. Tom Tillis is looking at his approval rating and his money. Martha McSally is looking at her approval rating and her money. Same with Joni Ernst. It's not looking so good. And so while some pro-Trump super PACs are going to try to help these people out to bolster up the troops and keep them on Trump's side and make sure they never say anything critical of him in public, they want to just sort of keep the attention on the House right now and not make any news and not make any waves. But I don't think that necessarily means okay. I'm not hopeful like Bill Kristol, unfortunately, mm-hmm. that they're going to really create, you know, a caucus of the righteous and do the right thing. But I'm saying that I think the tension is going to increase behind the scenes between the free thinkers and the Republican caucus conference and Mitch McConnell, and then also then between Mitch McConnell and the president, because there could be more, you know, SDNY news. There could be more sure. Bad news, more Rudy Giuliani interviews. We could get more documents out of nowhere suddenly. You know, Mike Pompeo is going to try to run for Senate, which is an amazing thing if you think about it. He's going to have to show up and answer questions either from the media or some voter somewhere about the fact that he turned the State Department over to Rudy Giuliani. So I think a lot can happen in January that will be very disruptive. I'm not talking about votes to convict. I'm talking about a rougher process than I think we perceive right now. It just sounds like we're all united. And I think Mitch McConnell has a way of saying, like, hey, for this week until we go on vacation, like, let's just project like everything's fine here. And I think that's smart. And I can see why they're playing along.
Okay,
There's plenty of time to make problems.
That all makes sense. And Bill Kristol tends to be a lot more optimistic than I am, but the idea of the Constitutional Caucus. But it does seem like it's an easy vote for many of these Republicans to at least say, look, I push for a, you know, fair and full trial. I didn't vote ultimately to convict the president, but at least I'm not going to be a rubber stamp for Mitch McConnell. It only takes four of them to do that. So it seems to me possible. But Mitch McConnell seems very, very confident that he's going to be able to set the rules here.
But see, Charlie, I think what we learned from the crazy six-page letter is what McConnell knows, which is that
he's crazy.
When Trump doesn't have like a pushback outlet and a way of having he needs these drama queen moments. And so if there's any dominating headlines right now about Cory Gardner and Mitt Romney having a meeting on process and rules and fairness, that they will get a letter like that.
Right.
I think Mitch McConnell's just saying, like, let's just everyone pretend everything's super up with people right now, and then we can have problems later. But they know that it's not just like Trump's going to turn on them for their election. It's that then the trial gets further destroyed.
Okay, no, that's a smart tantrum. This is a smart take.
Because you remember, he will tolerate no dissent.
Yeah,
so everything is perfect.
So that, I think that's a smart take. Were you at all surprised by Nancy Pelosi's success in getting virtually all of those moderate swing seat Democrats to vote with her?
I was really surprised by it because. Yeah. Even though I've talked to the National Security Democrats, some of them who are freshmen, who have said, I didn't come here to keep my seat. I had an amazing career. I'll have another, you know, chapter in my career. I've been in the armed forces and I've been a federal prosecutor or whatever. I mean, look at the resumes of these people. And I'm not just some penny ante politician who's been in Congress for 200 years and needs to keep her seat. So it's very interesting if you think about it that way, that they actually are liberated. I almost think they're willing, they're much more at peace with losing their seat than Nancy Pelosi is with losing her majority, especially if Trump is reelected. So you can say, oh, they just had to do this or they wouldn't be able to fundraise. Mm-hmm. That's not true. Let me tell you who would have found them that money. Nancy Pelosi. If the base was mad and the Intercept came after them and the Bernie bros were disappointed and blah, 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 she would find them the money to help them hold their seat. And she, if Alyssa Slotkin had to call her last weekend and say, I just can't do it, she would say, I completely understand. Let's just keep you here.
Okay. So,
and so I think this idea that they just fell into a partisan line is a really a bunch of hooey. I think they were brave. I think they're liberated. I think they're protecting their integrity. And it's a lot easier to go to those town halls and say, you're right. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to do it. It's not fair. It's partisan.
So, many of these are freshmen, and so I'm guessing that they're still renting. They didn't buy, so there may be that they haven't really gotten into the whole Potomac the whole Potomac fever thing. But speaking of money, the Republicans are dumping lots of money into these districts, pounding on these Democrats. Is there an effort to back them up? Have the Democrats put anything, you know, into those districts to defend them, or is it asymmetrical?
Yeah, I don't know specifically of anything that they've come up with, but there was an alarm sounded, and I believe it's been addressed, or it will be. You know, I think that was a couple weeks back. The frontliners made it very clear that, you know, that we're getting pounded, and you need to have a plan in place for this. I don't know of specific ad campaigns or expenditures, but they got the message. So remember that the DCCC is in far better shape as an organization than the DNC. They're mm-hmm. they're much more responsive. They're much more forward thinking. The DNC is sort of just out to lunch.
Okay. So
we'll see. We'll see. You know, we'll see later on if I'm right. But I do know that they saw a need and they're jumping on it.
So one of the media narratives was about how Elise Stefanik had become this rising star in Trump world. But let's leave that aside for the moment. I have to say that the one guy who has really stepped up and found his voice, and I mentioned this before we started the podcast, is Justin Amash. And I'm going to admit that I was never, you know, really that focused on him, you know, except that he was, you know, out there sort of as a lone libertarian, as very contrarian. But his position and his articulation of the case against Donald Trump and his refusal to cave in on issues of principle, including these two massive, awful spending bills that just got rammed through. This is kind of Justin Amash's moment. And one measure of that was all of the speculation across party lines, I thought, that maybe Nancy Pelosi ought to make him one of the impeachment managers, send him over to the Senate to give it a little bit less of a partisan gloss. But this is kind of what is Justin Amash up to at the moment? Where do you think he goes from here?
It's so interesting because all we know is that one town hall where he went home and he was well received with a standing ovation. It's going to be really interesting to follow his campaign and then the ultimate outcome of the 2020 election in
because
his district.
He's running as an independent. He knew he couldn't win a Republican primary, probably.
Right. And so it's going to be very tough for him. I mean, obviously, Republicans are going to come after him at the direction of Trump because Trump, you know, will be vengeful. But I do think it's disappointing that Nancy Pelosi, I know she's a very she doesn't do out of the box crazy stuff like that. But I think it would have been the smart thing to do because he's an attorney. He's not a trial prosecutor, but he's a very smart guy and he's absolutely devoted to the Constitution, and which is why he's put himself into a very tough corner by, you know, he's a man alone, right? Like without a party. And I think he
Well, that's
he
why
would have
I,
made it not, not only would have made it like less partisan, but he would have made it really interesting. He's very passionate. He's very principled. He's very good friends, probably formerly with Mick Mulvaney. I mean, it's very dramatic. He's a founding member of the Freedom Caucus, and it would have been very searing to have him make the case. So I think it's an opportunity lost if she's decided no, which I think she has. But I think that he's a really fascinating person, and I really hope. Charlie, I always hope that there's support for independence. I desperately hope that someone can break from party and still survive.
Yeah, I was always skeptical that they were going to do that because, of course, one of the fears is that, Amash might run as a third party presidential candidate. And, they don't want to have their fingerprints on that at all. So the piece, and I strongly recommend people read this, Why Is Mitch McConnell Afraid of This Man? And it really connects the dots. AB's thought it really connects the dots between this ongoing investigation into Lev Parnas and all the things that we are learning, and the Republicans' apparent obsession with getting this trial over as quickly as possible. So it is, Why Is Mitch McConnell Afraid of This Man? In The Bulwark. AB Stoddard, thank you so much for coming in and talking to us today.
Thank you, Charlie. Always a pleasure.
And if I do not speak to you, Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays,
Merry Christmas.
Happy New Year, all the things
you
that we are
well.
Allowed to say that won't
trigger. Oh, 2020, we'll be in it soon. It's hard to believe.
Yeah, the decade is over, along with the year. I'm not going to get into a debate about whether this is the decade over or whether that's a year from now, because that's a dumb debate and I've never liked it. So, AB Stoddard, again, thank you so much for coming in. I appreciate it very, very much.
Thank you, Charlie.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.